Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. The New York Times decision to run a story about a secret government program to track international terrorist finances has sparked a noisy debate about national security and the responsibilities and rights of a free press. Conservative bloggers and commentators accuse the Times of treason. President Bush calls the decision to publish disgraceful, and at least one Republican congressman says the Times should be prosecuted. At issue are revelations by the paper about a far-reaching program to probe thousands of international wire transfers without judicial oversight. The Bush administration says the program is legal, but some legal experts aren't so sure, and critics call it part of a disturbing pattern of this president to reach beyond constitutional checks and balances. Up next on Point, the secret war on terror versus the public's right to know. And joining me from New York is great Gabriel Sherman. He's media critic for the New York Observer, and he's been following this story closely. And Gabriel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello, Anthony.
Start us off by reminding us what this is all about. What was the thrust of the New York Times story last week that has ignited this firestorm of protest, mainly from conservatives?
Well, Anthony, this is all about a story that was written, published on June 23rd, that disclosed a government program that allows the United States to tap into an international banking network that tracks international wire transfers known as a SWIFT network in Belgium.
Yeah, so this is a program that literally would allow the government to look at thousands and thousands of transactions of people moving money around from the U.S. to the U.S., from Europe and elsewhere in the world, and to the U.S., correct?
Exactly. And what, you know, what the government says is they are only sifting through records of people that are, you know, so-called suspects or known associates of Al-Qaeda. Now, privacy experts warn that, you know, tapping into this network is a breach of privacy, and perhaps innocent people will be caught up in these searches.
Mm. What did the Times say about this program's effectiveness? Is it working?
You know, they've said it's effective, and they basically have said it's legal, although some people say there are legal issues surrounding the program. But, you know, they've said this has been something that the government has trumpeted since 9/11, that they are going to crack down and track terror financing.
Hmm. Now, conservatives have lined up and protested with words like treason. Representative Peter King from New York is talking about prosecution of Times reporters and editors. Summarize their beef. What's up? What are they upset about in particular?
Basically, conservatives have used this as a political soccer ball of sorts and have characterized the Times' reporting on this matter as a breach of national security, as unpatriotic in a time of war, as giving aid to the enemy. And they've used the Times as a way to rally their base, as undermining America's war on terror.
Well, we're going to hear in just a moment from one of those voices. But, Gabriel, talk to me a little bit about Representative Peter King from New York, who's talking about prosecution of Times reporters and editors. Is there any indication that could happen, and if so, how would prosecution work? Who would be prosecuted, and for what, and under what set of laws?
Well, I'm not a legal expert, but from reporting on the story, one of the arguments used by conservatives is that the Times has breached the 1917 Espionage Act, which makes it illegal to disclose state secrets. Now, legal experts are split over whether this is actually possible, because, as we know, this country is founded with the freedom of the press. First Amendment rights usually trump any sort of limit on press freedom. Now, this would be sort of a watershed moment if the Justice Department actually takes this up and prosecutes the Times, its editors, and reporters under the Espionage Act. It's a huge unknown and a huge issue weighing on the press right now.
And has the Justice Department said anything about this? Has the Attorney General chimed in at all on this to date?
You know, they John Negroponte has said that they're going to do a damage assessment. I think it's too early to really know what course of action the Justice Department will take up. In the past, Attorney General Gonzalez has sort of hinted that the Justice Department would consider prosecuting news organizations for disclosing classified information, but it still remains to be seen whether this will go forward.
Well, Gabriel Sherman, thanks so much for setting the scene for us today. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Gabriel Sherman, media critic for the New York Observer. And I'm happy to welcome now Heather McDonald, who joins us from Irvine, California. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor to City Journal, and author of the article National Security Be Damned in the recent edition of the Weekly Standard. Heather McDonald, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me, Anthony.
Now, I'm looking at a recent column of yours in the Weekly Standard that begins with this line: by now it's undeniable, the New York Times is a national security threat. Can you talk about that? Do you really believe that, the New York Times is a national security threat?
I think they have shown utter contempt for the will of the public that has been expressed again and again, that covert actions are legitimate, that in war, as well as in criminal investigations, it is perfectly appropriate to conduct certain investigative activities in secret. Indeed, it is virtually impossible to break a terrorist ring if you're going to be publicizing your investigative methods. And so I think the New York Times, in publishing this story without any explicit evidence that it's illegal, in publishing the fact of this program, has shown complete disregard for the public will and the need to protect this country.
Let me just stop you there, because I want to go back and forth with you a bit on this. I mean, the Times story, in defense of the Times, does raise some credible doubts about the program's legality, does it not?
I mean, it does not. It says there's unnamed people that say, well, maybe there's some doubts. You know, you can find people that doubt that the New York Times is a newspaper. It has raised no actual arguments as to why this program is illegal. In fact, in 1977, Congress gave the executive branch administrative subpoena power to investigate international financial transactions.
But Heather, as I look at the story, we're talking about, I mean, among other things, a fairly murky and hard to understand law. I'm no expert here, but the New York Times makes reference to the 1978 Right to Financial Privacy Act. So, I mean, are you telling me, and they're citing legal experts that say this program could run afoul of that, and so let's debate this. Let's get this out in the open and talk about it.
Well, Anthony, you've seen arguments that I haven't then, because all I've seen is
I just read the article.
Raise the possibility that it may be abused. And, you know, every government power contains within it the possibility of abuse. Does that mean that because wiretaps can be abused, if the New York Times gets wind that there's a wiretap on Osama bin Laden, that it's going to reveal it? I've yet to see any credible arguments that this was a violation of the law. The administration has been repeatedly briefing Congress. It was visited by delegations of Democratic as well as Republican leaders, urging them that this is a legal program and a necessary one. It allowed the administration to find Hambali, who was responsible for the 2002 Bali bombings. Mm. Again, the logic of the Times here is completely unbounded. It means that there is simply no program, and it especially gets a case of the vapors whenever there's a database involved. Well, at this point, you know, there's unlikely to be any activity that terrorists engage in that is not contained in some electronic database.
Yeah,
now,
but Heather,
that is the standard for the Times, that because databases are somehow scary, that if there's a database involved, we're going to reveal it. Again, there is simply an end to the ability to investigate terrorist activity.
But Heather, let me throw another idea at you. I don't think it's that databases are scary. I think it's not a new idea that the Bush administration could be, and I'm not saying that I believe this. I'm just saying there are credible suggestions and evidence that the Bush administration could be overstepping its authority. You admit that there are credible concerns about warrantless surveillance program that deserves scrutiny. The Bush administration has sort of a master record that suggests, you know, it's in the public interest to scrutinize what it's doing and to reveal to the public some of its strategies in this war on terror. So why not this program? Why does this program fall outside of that kind of scrutiny?
Because there are no credible allegations, Anthony. I did not criticize the Times for revealing the National Security Administration wiretaps. I thought those were, at face value, a violation of FISA, and I was not persuaded by the government's Article II arguments. I have seen no argument for why this is a violation. The argument that there is a hypothetical possibility of abuse applies to everything the government does, including every covert activity. And the Times has simply decided that if somebody raises the hypothetical possibility of abuse, they're going to reveal it. As I say, our terrorist investigations are at an end. And let me also respond to the allegations of Gabriel that somehow this represents a effort to rally the base. I can
look, Heather.
You,
we'll
I
get that.
No interest in rallying the conservative base. I'm not a spokesman for anybody.
Heather, you're going to be with us for the rest of the hour, and we'll get to that. I just want to very quickly go to one point before the break and get you to respond to that. You know, the idea that we have blown the cover on an important program that has endangered national security. Do you really think that blowing the cover on this program has endangered national security? Because the idea that the administration was going after international financier, looking at the ways that that money moves across international borders, wasn't new. I mean, the Times revealed some details about that idea. But the idea that we were going after international financing of terrorist organizations, certainly not a new idea.
Well, that's rather a self-contradictory argument, isn't it, then? Because if they're saying that there's nothing new here, why are they running it on the front cover?
With me from Irvine, California, is Heather McDonald. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and her article, National Security Be Damned, was published in the recent edition of the Weekly Standard. In a moment, we expect to be joined by Eric Lischblau, one of the reporters who reported this story for the New York Times, but we're waiting him to arrive. And in the meantime, I'd like to welcome into the conversation Marvin Kalb. He's a senior fellow at the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. He worked for 30 years as a correspondent for CBS and NBC. His most recent book is The Media and the War on Terrorism. And Marvin Kalb, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony. Nice to be with you.
Well, you've been listening to Heather McDonald's concerns. I'd like to know what you make of this outcry against the New York Times. What do you make of it? Were they right to go with this story?
My answer is yes. My answer is that the New York Times had not only the right to run this story, but probably the obligation to run this story.
Why is that?
Well, because I think that this is an important story having to do with the war on terror. We are involved in a war on terror, and it seems to me that the more information that the public has, the better, as a society, we would be able to focus on the war on terror. Let's remember something that the late Justice Potter Stewart said, and this was quoted in today's editorial in the Washington Post, and I'm not quoting him directly because I don't have the Post in front of me, but it was something like a virile and vital press is absolutely essential to the maintenance of a free and open society. Mm-hmm. And I think the public can make up its mind about whether it's good to have more or adequate information or it's bad. My own feeling is it has always been proven to be correct, right?
Mm-hmm. Heather McDonald, jump in here. I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but I'd like Marvin Kalb to respond to some of the arguments you've made. Chief among them, this idea that there has to be this line, and the New York Times, by blowing the cover, essentially, of this program, is compromising national security. Did I sum up your position correctly, Heather?
Yeah, I think the New York Times clearly has the right to run this story. I do not believe it has an obligation to run it. I think that, like all power, there has to be responsibility in exercising it, and I think it was irresponsible to run this story. Again, there is no line that I can see that would divide this story from any other lawful covert operation that the government is operating. Does this mean that, as I say, that if the New York Times gets wind of a lawful wiretap on Osama bin Laden, that too is a very, very important story on the war on terror. It is something that would be pursuant to congressional authorization. Does this mean that the Times exposes it? It has the power to do so, but I think that there has to be a responsible decision about whether that is in the public interest to do so. You know, there's a lot of interesting...
Let Marvin Kalb get into...
It would be in the public interest right now for the New York Times to reveal its sources for this story. Why is it not done so? That, too, is an important story on the war on terror. Why is the Times deciding that it's not in the public interest to reveal who in the government decided to go to the Times about this covert program?
Marvin Kalb, do you want to respond to that?
Oh, sure. I'd love to. I think, number one, that this kind of a story run in the New York Times, and let us also quickly point out, everyone is focusing on the New York Times, including you, Anthony, and everybody on this program. But other newspapers also ran this story. The Washington Post ran it, but late. The L.A. Times ran it on time. The Wall Street Journal, which is not exactly a voice of liberal opinion, also ran this story. So it divides not according to a liberal newspaper or a conservative newspaper, but a newspaper and what it should be doing at this particular time.
Let me make this point, please. Go ahead, Marvin.
Okay. This is more than anything the exception rather than the rule as to what journalism does. Most of the time, and I stress this, most of the time, when a government goes to a newspaper, a network, a magazine, and says, please, don't run this information, it could damage the nation, the editors sit back and most of the time agree with the government. It is the exception when they break from the government request and run it against what the government may take to be the interest, the national interest of the country. I think that's a very important point for people to understand. Years ago, when President Kennedy was in power, the Bay of Pigs took place. He said at the very beginning, when the New York Times found out about this, that the Times shouldn't run this story. Afterward, he acknowledged to the Times editor and publisher that he, the president, had made a mistake by requesting the Times not to do this, because he said if the information were out there, it would have been much more helpful to the national interests of this country.
Heather McDonald, go ahead. That idea that Marvin Kalb raises, that there's real value to revealing this, and that the public needs to know this and can benefit from it in ways that we might not even understand today, but might take some time to fully appreciate as time goes by. What do you make of that?
I see no value whatsoever. I cannot possibly imagine the value of alerting terrorists to the fact that if they put in their financial transactions through this consortium SWIFT, that the government is on their side. I think that this story about the Bay of Pigs has been recently recycled endlessly by the Times, by the LA Times. To me, it sounds like buck passing on Kennedy's part and a effort to shun responsibility for bad decisions. That's the only, and I don't think it is at all bears on the fact that this is a lawful, covert program that I think you have a consensus across the political spectrum. You have John Murtha coming in there. You have Lee Hamilton begging the Times not to publish it. I see no relevance for the Bay of Pigs, and this is not a liberal or a conservative issue.
Mm-hmm. We've made that point. Let me welcome into the conversation Eric Lischblau, who's been listening for the last few minutes. And Eric, thanks for joining us. Eric Lischblau, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. He co-authored the June 23rd article that revealed the government program of tracking international banking data. And Eric, thanks again. You've been listening to some of the concerns raised by Heather McDonald. I'd love you to respond to them. This idea that there's no value in alerting readers to a covert program that had broad support of many across the government.
Well, a couple of points on that. And first of all, the idea that we are alerting to the terrorists to the idea that their finances may be tracked, I think, is misguided. I think that they have been alerted to that for the last 4.5 years by President Bush and by numerous aides, including former Treasury Secretary Snow and others. That drumbeat has been constant from the administration, and it's such a poorly kept secret, if you could even call it that, that there have been numerous stories about how the terrorists have, for years now, been moving their money out of the financial institutions because they know their money is being tracked. USA Today, the biggest circulation in the country, wrote a story to that effect weeks before our story ran. So I think the idea that we're tipping the terrorists off to something they don't know is a bit odd in my mind. And as far as the point that there's no important value to this debate, I mean, there's certainly legal and public policy issues that kind of go to the heart of prosecuting the war on terrorism.
Well, so, I would say that...
Yeah, go ahead, Heather McDonald.
So are terrorists the only ones who've been alerted to this? If that's the case, that every terrorist out there is on a minute-by-minute basis conscious of what he's doing, why hasn't the public also been alerted? Why is this a story then? If it's so universally known, why is this a front-page story that the Times was proud to publish? You can't have it both ways. The fact is that wiretaps work. You could say this about every mafia don. Every mafia don has always known that there's a capacity to have wiretaps on his phones. They do it anyway. And again, how do you explain the Hambali case? If everybody knew this was going on, then either you don't need to run the story or you can't explain how you were able to catch terrorists through this program.
Okay, Heather, you put the question on the table. Let's let Eric Lischblau respond.
Well, I mean, the value to running the story, it seems clear to me from the debate that we've had for over the last year with the NSA story and others, is how you go about prosecuting the war on terrorism, checks and balances in government. It speaks to a broad reading of presidential authority, the question of how long we will be using extraordinary emergency measures to fight the war on terrorism. These are all critical questions for public debate, and I think that the paper decided that those were issues that outweighed what seemed like a tough to follow argument that the terrorists are not already aware of this. And I would correct Heather on one point. She's simply wrong when she says that John Mercer and others pleaded with us not to run the story. I'm not going to go any further than that, but that's a mischaracterization of what happened.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We do have a lot of listeners who'd like to get into this conversation, so I'm going to ask my guests to just stand by. And let's go to Kathleen, who's calling from Washington, D.C. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, good morning. How are you, Anthony?
Very well, thanks. Thanks
good.
For the
let
call.
Me, let me just be right to the point. I am an African-American woman, New York Times reader. My community was assaulted with COINTELPRO and the National Security Council Memorandum Number 46 that was to disrupt my community in terms of our doing any business with Africa, because apartheid was the better interest for the United States, at least at that time in 1978. Now, I applaud the New York Times and every story that they write, because the issue, Heather McDonald comes up with this issue about lawful wiretaps. The whole issue of whether these programs are lawful is in play. So the idea of bringing this to the public so that we can have the one little teeny opportunity that we might have to even examine the lawfulness of this, I think is applaudable. 9/11 was Bush's Reichstag, and I will leave it at that. And thank you, Anthony, for having this kind of program.
Kathleen, thanks for your call. Heather McDonald, you heard it there from Washington, D.C. And Kathleen, I mean, she appreciates this kind of this kind of reporting and feels that there's a precedent for it, and that there is, you know, some valuable questions that need to be answered here in terms of what the Bush administration has been doing.
Well, again, I would like to hear those. I would like to hear what the credible allegations are that this is a illegal program. As I see it, it is pursuant to the law. So,
but you keep saying that. What I'm not clear about is this.
Congress decides to authorize covert actions and then turn around and say we're going to reveal every covert action because there's a possibility of abuse. At some point, I think it is up to newspapers to act responsibly and make a decision about what really you cannot simply invoke the public interest in a broad way without specifically deciding in this case when we absolutely need to stop the cash flow of terrorists that a what appears to be a completely lawful program should be revealed. And
but
again,
Heather, wait a minute. It appears to be lawful, but it seems like Eric Lischblau was reporting about one aspect of the article, and I'd like to get him to sort of draw this out a little bit, and that is this 1978 Right to Financial Privacy Act that you made reference to. And it seems like you had some folks in there who were worried that that law was being violated with this program. Is that correct?
Well, I think that it's fair to say that this is a legally gray area. It is not nearly as clear-cut as Heather and some people might make it out to be. There are numerous privacy restrictions that restrict and in some cases prohibit the ability of the government to get access to private financial information without some established relevance as to why they need those records. There are even stronger international UN and EU restrictions. In the view of the administration, those are trumped by the emergency economic powers that the president invoked after 9/11. It's not for me to say who's in the right in that legal debate, but virtually everyone we talk to acknowledge that this is a legally gray area, that this was a program that sort of stretched the envelope in terms of the reading of presidential authority, and that, relied on an aggressive, and I'm not suggesting illegal or improper, but certainly an aggressive reading of the law. And to my mind, those are all points for public debate.
Joan is calling from Hamilton, Ontario. Hi, Joan.
Hello.
Thanks for joining the program. What's on your mind?
Well, may I preface this by saying I'm one of the 95% of Canadians who do not approve of what the Bush administration has been doing in Iraq, and that I'm not a conservative. But I found it interesting that Anthony started this by saying that it's the conservatives who are upset. Well, if that were true, for a couple of years here in Canada, we've been watching the liberals in the United States, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, going absolutely berserk over the relatively unimportant fact that was outed. When even her neighbors on her street, as I understand it, knew she was CIA, and people had to go to jail, according to the liberals, for this terrible crime.
You're referring to the outing of Valerie Plame as a CIA officer, the wife of Mr. Wilson. It's a good point. I'm glad you bring it up, Joan. Let's throw it to our panel. Marvin Kalb, do you see a difference there? Joan from Ontario says, why get upset about why be upset about the Valerie Plame outing and then come down on this as some right that the press has to publish?
Yeah, well, I think that it is wonderful for people to be upset about all kinds of stories, whether it's Valerie Plame or this story about finances through this SWIFT organization. There are two issues, if I may throw them in this point of the discussion. Heather makes the point time and time again about whether this is lawful, and she says it's legal and everybody knew it. I'm not sure that everybody knew it. And whether it is lawful or not is not the only central issue. Sometimes stories are run not because they're exposing an unlawful activity, but simply because the story itself has inherent value for the entire nation. So let's not keep focusing on legal or not. I am not a lawyer, and I don't know that it's illegal. Point number two has to do with responsibility. Journalists are constantly accused of irresponsibility when, in fact, that is not the case. Most journalists are extremely responsible about the way in which they conduct their activities. Most of the editors that I know, particularly those at the New York Times, are extremely responsible. They have... For example, when the NSA story ran last December, the New York Times considered for more than 1 year whether to run the story. They listened to everybody, including the President of the United States. They decided to run it. It was their right. They may have been wrong. And let us say that they were. Nevertheless, the issue is very important for the public to understand, to be able to read about. I find it extremely troubling that a member of the United States Congress can call for the prosecution of the New York Times for running a story, which
this
Congressman
doesn't like.
This is Peter
King, Republican Peter King of New York.
King of New York, that is correct. And for a number of other members of Congress to call for the revocation of the license, the ability of the New York Times to cover Congress, that's absurd.
Well, Heather McDonald, you don't go that far, do you?
No, and I would take very strong objection to the way you characterize this issue, Anthony, and in the beginning of your segment right now. Do you believe in the freedom of the press, or do you think there should be a line drawn about what the press should publish? I believe in the freedom of the press. I think that it is up to the press to exercise responsibility. If you can, you're saying basically if you criticize the decision to publish covert information, lawfully gathered covert information, that you were somehow attacking the freedom of the press. What you're suggesting is the press is beyond criticism. Nobody, the decision of Peter King is his own matter, but I think that for you to equate criticism of the Times decision with an attack on freedom of the press is extremely unfair.
No, Heather, I'll take that to heart. I think the question that I should have phrased that question is, how far should freedom of the press go, and where should the line be drawn between what should and shouldn't be printed? I think that's how I should have phrased that, and I think that's sort of what we're focusing on.
But the line is being drawn every single day in every single newsroom. Decisions are made every single day. Heather, I didn't interrupt you, did I?
Go ahead, Marvin.
Decisions are made every single day in a newsroom as to what is right. Those decisions, most of the time, are made in a very responsible manner. If they weren't, those papers would go out of business.
I agree with Mr. Kalb. I think he's right. That doesn't mean that when somebody...
All right, I'm out of here.
No, don't leave us. Don't leave us, Marvin. Stand by. I want to introduce another guest, another voice into the conversation from Washington, D.C., Roger Cressy. He's president of Good Harbor Consulting, where he advises clients on homeland security, cybersecurity, and counterterrorism issues. He's also an on-air counterterrorism expert for NBC News. And Roger Cressy, welcome.
Good to be here, Anthony. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to this debate, and we sort of wanted to come to you with a sort of broad theme of, someone who tracks, is concerned about counterterrorism issues. You know, where do we draw this line? Where does this line between being sensitive about national security and keeping the public informed, where do we draw that line? How do we keep that as part of a healthy democracy?
Well, Anthony, besides being a talking head on NBC, let me also say that I was a counterterrorism official at the National Security Council in both the Clinton and Bush administrations. So I've seen this issue from both sides now. And the first observation is everyone needs to take a deep breath on this for several reasons. And the first is the use of SWIFT and monitoring SWIFT transactions has been publicly known for several years. In fact, the United Nations thought it was such a great idea, they included it in one of their reports in 2002, where they referenced specifically how the U.S. was applying new monitoring techniques to spot and verify suspicious financial transactions. And then they said, we think this is a good idea and others should do it. Second point is, this is a good program from a policy perspective. It's the type of thing that before 9/11, I wish we could have been more aggressive on and done more of. I believe it's completely legal, although I'm not a lawyer and I definitely don't play one on the radio, but the President's International Economic Emergency Powers Act, which is very broad authority and was passed after the Iranian hostage crisis, when it's used the right way, can help us follow the money. So this is the right thing we should do, and I'm glad we are doing it. Now, that all said, when you shine the spotlight on this type of program, as the Times did, it is somewhat counterproductive. That doesn't mean it's so counterproductive that the program can't stand up in the public eye. But when the White House and the President and the Vice President talk about it in a way they have, that brings international attention to it, compounded with the New York Times story. So taken together, you're shining far more of a spotlight on this than, frankly, we should.
Okay. There's a sort of middle view of the issue. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Eduard, who is calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Eduard.
Hello. I'm calling to strongly support Heather MacDonald. I think that we tend to talk about the press quite often as holier than God. And at the end, to me, the New York Times is a business engaged in the business of selling newspapers. So you have on one side the right and their goal to sell more newspapers, and on the other, my own personal safety and security. And that's the bottom line for me.
Okay, Eduard. Well, thanks for putting that on the table. Roger, let me come back to you with the idea that Eduard puts on the table, the idea of national security should be the press's number one priority. I mean, is that realistic, or how should the press weigh that in their consideration of whether or not to publish a story?
Well, Anthony, I spend a lot of time with members of the media, both in the public and in the print forums. And shocking as this might come to some, they're very patriotic. But their job is to find out information and report it. And ultimately, it revolves down to a judgment call on their part as to what is appropriate and what is not. And there, I can tell you from personal experience when I worked at the White House, there are plenty of times when a White House, both Republican and Democrat, would ask the media to hold information or to kill stories, and they have in the past. There are other times when they've been asked to do it, and they went forward. And a good example of that is the Washington Post expose on the rendition process. Now, even in that case, the Washington Post withheld the identity of several countries where individuals were rendered to because they felt that crossed the line in terms of operational information that was inappropriate to be put in the public domain. Mm. So, you know, I understand the frustration people have with this, but I also believe that any program the United States government runs, if for whatever reason it comes to the public light, and maybe if it shouldn't be in the public light, but nonetheless it makes it there, it has to be defensible. It has to be a program that will stand up to the public glare. In the case of the rendition program, which is far more sensitive and critical than SWIFT, quite frankly, that program has been able to stand up in the public glare, and I'm sure this one will too.
Heather McDonald, I want to come to you. And first of all, I need to alert my listeners. We lost Marvin Kalb. He gave up on this conversation and left, but we appreciated the time that he was with us and hope that he'll come back to our program soon. Heather McDonald, your feeling in general, not you know, moving beyond this particular story about the New York Times, but to pick up on Roger Cressy's point, overall, do you think the press handles this kind of balance fairly, reasonably well?
With regards to the war on terror?
With regard on this fine balance between the right to publish, the need to publish, the need to inform, and to be sensitive to security issues.
Well, I don't think there's been anything of this magnitude that has been revealed. So, again, as I say, I think the national security program was a much closer call, and I think you can make a credible argument that the Times was correct in bringing that out because it did appear to violate a statute. This program does not. So, up to now, I don't think there's been anything of this order. And the fact that most journalists are responsible, as Mr. Kalb says, does not mean that when they make an extraordinarily irresponsible decision that they should be beyond criticism. I think, again, I'm not for prosecuting the Times, but I think that public shaming is perfectly appropriate to bring them more aware of the responsibility that comes with power. Yes, they have freedom, but that freedom should be exercised with responsible choices, and this, to me, was simply a knee-jerk attempt to try and pursue their notion that the Bush administration is wildly out of control, and I don't think there's any evidence for that.
Well, let's take a couple more calls. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for coming on the show. What's up?
I'm one of those people who thinks that the executive branch is wildly out of control. And I really look to the news media as the only source we have left in this country to watchdog what's going on. I think, for instance, the Congress has totally fallen on its face. We wouldn't have known about the whole NSA issue if it weren't for the media. The watchdog agencies that are supposed to be watching it weren't watching it. And the most shocking thing to me was after Congress found out that the executive basically said, I don't care what types of laws you pass because of the FISA Act, we just don't have to listen to them. Congress has done absolutely nothing. It's only the newspapers that are safeguarding what's the thin shred that separates us between a complete, the type of government that we escaped when we had a revolution in this country a couple hundred years ago. My final point is really that the patriotic thing for an American citizen to do is to not trust any human being who's in a place of government. It is unpatriotic to explicitly trust the government. And it's the newspaper's role, the fourth estate, to constantly mistrust and be skeptical.
Okay, Sam, we got it. The media as the watchdog and sort of the expression of a healthy public skepticism. Heather McDonald, respond there to Sam about that point. And he sees this story as a legitimate part of that.
Well, I still would like somebody to explain to me if there are any covert programs that the press should honor. You know, you can find people that believe that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a secret court to oversee wiretaps in the case of terrorism and espionage, shouldn't exist, that nothing should be secret. So the American public, through its representatives, has decided that there are times when covert action in fighting terrorism is justified. does this mean, because we are so mistrustful of government, that every time we may get wind of a FISA covert tap on a terrorist, that this should be revealed? I still am waiting for somebody to give me a line.
But isn't it the responsibility? But Heather, and let me put this to Roger Cressy, isn't it the responsibility of the press, if the press knows about a covert program, to do what it can to try to understand if it's legal? And if there are legitimate questions being raised about it, then to publish it and debate it and talk about it. Is that a misguided approach, Roger Cressy? To take Heather's point one step further and say, if we had the ability to sort of take a look at every single covert program, I mean, should we just accept them, faithfully accept them, that they're going to be legal, or is it okay to be critical about them?
Well, the press has an obligation to hold the government accountable, both Republican and Democrat, White House and Congress. But the legal responsibility for accountability and oversight is the United States Congress. And if the Congress is not doing their job, then others may feel they have a requirement to do more. I'm not sure that's the right answer, but that's one answer. But let me give Heather an example of where the media did keep its mouth shut for operational reasons. In the spring of last year, Abu Faraj al-Libi, may have been this year, Abu Faraj al-Libi, a senior al-Qaeda operative, was running around in Pakistan. Central Intelligence Agency, working with the Pakistan government, was very aggressively monitoring his communications and trying to track him down. Several news outlets got wind of this effort, and the agency went to these news outlets, both print and media, and said, if you talk about this right now, we run the risk of losing this guy. And this guy is in the process of trying to develop programs to kill Americans. So we're asking you, for operational reasons, not to do it. And guess what? Everyone kept their mouth shut until after Faraj was placed in U.S. custody as a result of a joint U.S.-Pakistani operation. Then, of course, everyone talked about the events leading up to his capture, the TikTok. But that's a great example where we did, and I have to say we because I'm part of the media now in one way, shape, mm-hmm. or form, we did not talk about something that was operational. So when you compare something like that to the Swift revelation, and by the way, I do not believe it's a revelation based on my knowledge of working these issues in the White House and what was already in the public domain. I think we're making a mountain out of a molehill on this particular issue.
Let's go to Bob, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Bob.
Yes, good morning.
Good day. Thanks for calling.
Please. For Heather specifically, I am not a Times reader. I'm a Wall Street Journal reader. I consider myself rather conservative. I am amazed at this palaver, because I think that what's happening here is that the administration and others have used this as an excuse to beat up on the Times, who I have no intention of defending, because the Times has been taking them to task on many, many issues. Why not pick on the Wall Street Journal? They ran the same story. What's the difference?
Okay, well, let's let Heather McDonald respond. It's true, Heather, it does seem to be that you and other critics are singling out the New York Times and not going after the other papers that also published the story.
Because the other papers were simply playing catch-up. They made the decision to run it after the Times put it on their website, and it was clear that it was the Times that was taking the lead on this.
Well, they broke the story, but isn't the Wall Street Journal implicitly supporting the New York Times by doing that? So why not go after them and criticize them as well?
But once you break the story, I mean, it's like Keller's amazingly juvenile criticism in his
You're talking about Bill Keller, the editor of the New York Times.
Right. Bill Keller said, well, if this is so awful, why are people criticizing us? Why are so-called conservative bloggers bringing this out? Aren't they revealing it as well? I mean, once it's revealed, you're not going to not write about the story. So it was the Times' judgment that controlled the situation here. And the idea that the Wall Street Journal's editorial page is very, very conservative, there's no question about that. It's the only conservative editorial page in the country, but the news side is completely separate. So the idea that people are not criticizing the Wall Street Journal because somehow it's a conservative paper is ludicrous. But again, the fact is that this was the Times' baby, and the others were merely playing catch-up.
Okay, Heather McDonald, I think we have to leave it there because our time has run out. But I want to thank you so much for coming in and keeping this debate lively and informative. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Anthony. Thank
That's
you.
Heather McDonald, fellow at the Manhattan Institute. And Roger Cressy, thank you so much, president of Good Harbor Consulting, where you advise clients on homeland security, cybersecurity, and counterterrorism issues. Thank you, Roger, for joining us today.
Pleasure, Anthony. Thank you.
And my thanks to Marvin Kalb, senior fellow at the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University, who joined us early in the hour, as did Gabriel Sherman, media critic for the New York Observer, and Eric Lischblau, reporter for the New York Times. You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.